Paul had so many interesting ideas sticking out of what he was talking about this morning that I'm actually having a great deal of difficulty whipping myself back to the thing that I've got to talk about. I guess there'll be another day that we can talk about some of these other ideas, but I can't pass by one or two observations real quick. The concept of who owns a corporation as well as who manages a corporation is one which really deserves some good reflection on your part. The management that Paul was talking about is indeed a serious problem, an interesting problem. Think also a little bit about the ownership of it. Of course, you all know that a corporation is owned by the shareholders, the stockholders. But who are the shareholders of a corporation? The corporation is the American invention. There's no question about this. It's one of the great contributions that we have made to civilization. Random thought in that department, too. You know, I've often thought that had the corporation existed at the time of Pope Leo, the Roman Catholic Church might never have had celibacy. Title to land vested in human beings, and there was no way to divest the child from some interests in real property. And if the title to the church lands had to be in a human being, and if he could marry and could not be divested of an interest, the church's lands would get scattered. The only way to avoid that was to have the title held by someone who had no legitimate heirs. Maybe I can hear stress legitimate. The way to prevent a person from having legitimate heir was, of course, no marriage. All of this could have been avoided if there had been a corporation to take title to the land at that time. And someday I'd like to see a historian go back and take a good, close look and see whether or not there is more than just coincidence in the fact that celibacy in the around 800s, was that about the time of Leo? Celibacy came to the Roman Catholic priesthood at the same time that the church began to develop extensive ownership in land and had no available corporation to hold title. But the corporation, as we know today, to get back to what I was starting out to talk about, is interesting because of the fact that so many of the shares are held by funds, trusts, retirement funds, and this kind of thing. And, of course, who owns a trust fund? Well, it's the people who manage the trust fund. And who manages the trust fund? Well, it's the people who are appointed by the trust. What trust? The corporation trust. And here you have a neat trick of a corporation running itself with no visible means of control on the outside. You know, there aren't any large blocks of shareholders in large corporations other than these fund sorts of organizations. And when you start looking for the ownership, you've got a legal entity which in effect sort of owns itself and doesn't have any other existence in terms of responsibility or accountability back to anyone. And that's either a very profound thought or complete nonsense, and I've never quite decided which, but it deserves a little reflection. The other thing I'd like to talk about is this matter of relative payments. One of the things that I once found in a corporation that I was visiting was an attempt to hold its technical people, chemists, physicists, geologists, etc., in their own areas of proficiency and not let them get over to the administrative side, become executives, by setting up salary promotion ladders or scales in their own proficiencies without making it necessary for them to flop to the executive positions to get increases in salary. They had what they called the blue ladder for professional people, technical people, scientific people, and the white ladder for administrative types. And they were really quite proud of it. I remember asking them, well, what is the maximum amount that a chemist, for example, could earn on the blue ladder? And they said, well, they assumed that probably they would not pay them more than the general president of the corporation was paid, probably would not go above that. The general president of this corporation was a little over $200,000 a year in his salary, plus allowances, one type or another. And then the obvious next question is, well, how much do you in fact pay your top chemist? Well, $28,000. So there was still some room for improvement in the one ladder compared to the other. These things can look awfully good on paper sometimes. Now, I'd like to talk about some other things there someday, but I'll have to wait for another time. I've been trying to develop an idea with you the last couple mornings, and I'll pursue it again this morning and again tomorrow morning. The idea of controls which society exercises in various groupings through law. The grouping of the family as being sort of a microcosm of society, with the very great amount of freedom that's given to the members of the family to control themselves internally, with control being exercised by society only where the family impinges upon interests outside of its own organization. That is, at the point of formation, the point of dissolution, and at the place where the family stands in opposition or conflict with outsiders, such as purchase of property, renting a home, and so forth. Secondly, we talked about juveniles as presenting a problem where the control of the youngster in the family starts very definitely to become a public interest outside, where society feels a very great obligation to take a look at the way kids are handled, but finds itself, that is, society finds itself trapped here by a problem of wanting to protect the integrity of the human being as an individual, protect the integrity of parents as parents, and so forth, and comes up with a sort of a solution that says, well, adults are adults and they have rights, legal rights, constitutional rights. Minors are not. They are persons who are already under a guardianship, and this is simply a shift from one type of guardianship, that is, that the guardianship of the parents to the guardianship of the state. We take the third step this morning when we talk about the law of crimes, where society starts breathing real hard on an individual for an offense against society. And how we handle that one, and tomorrow morning, to round out this particular sequence, we'll get to the international criminals, the North Vietnams, the Koreas, the United States, Red Chinas, and so forth, and try to talk about the controls, peace through law, the controls which society tries to exercise in the big family of nations instead of the little family of people. And this is supposed to be a sequence, a progression, and presumably there is some negotiability of technique from one of these types of patterns to the next. It's another thought that I had while Paul was talking this morning. If you could have outlined what Paul said in terms of his major philosophic or jurisprudential statements and lay them over what I intend to say this morning, you would be struck by the similarity of the techniques that are used, the almost identity of method that goes into labor's attempt to control the economic society and the state's attempt to control its social behavior through what we call criminal law. The criminal law, I think, is interesting to most people today, largely in context to what the United States Supreme Court has been doing. People are saying to me quite frequently, surely the justices have flipped their wigs. They're making it almost impossible for a policeman to arrest the criminal, and almost impossible to convict him, and almost impossible to keep him in jail. The protections of society from the thug, the robber, and the murderer, and so forth, are being eroded seriously by the recent decisions of the United States Supreme Court. And what's going on, anyway? Aren't we entitled to some protection, and so forth? It's a problem that deserves your careful attention. I'd like to try and simplify it a little bit by breaking it down into three points this morning. One is the first one, the question of what is the criminal law? How is it unique or distinct from the civil law? And why is it the way that it is? And why do we have a criminal law which stands in distinction from the civil law? A second point, what do you do with a man after you have found him to be guilty of a crime? How should you handle him? What are your objectives? And third thing I'd like to talk about is really an example of the first two in the rather dramatic context of capital punishment, where we can see some of these things in actual application rather more clearly because it is a dramatic case. The nature of the criminal law itself, I think, is best seen by starting out a little bit historically. In the history of law, and who knows where to stick your finger into it, it goes back as far as human experience goes, but pick it out someplace around the development of our law in its present form, say in England, or perhaps some of its roots in the continent of Europe during the Dark Ages, and you would have found that there was no such thing as a separate body of civil law and a separate body of criminal law. There was just plain law, and it was usually represented by the king, the employer, the benevolent despot, or one who was not so benevolent that Paul was talking about this morning. And when a person did something which was in violation of the law, the folk ways, the tribal mores, or whatever other name you wanted to give it, the official simply reacted to it. Now, if this thing which someone did happened to be something which took the vigor or the life or the fighting hand of one of the members of the tribe or of the village, the king was apt to retaliate by requesting this offender to reimburse the people for the harm that he had caused. Somebody caused me to lose my arm, and the compensation went not to me, but to my society, because society was injured. It wasn't so much that I was injured, because I belonged to my group, to my society. And our law started this way. The counterpart of this, you see, is that there was no such thing as private ownership of goods, private property. And so I really wasn't hurt. What I had and what I was and what I worked with, the house that I lived and so forth, belonged in a very real sense to my family, to my town, to my village, to my tribe, to my group. Now, from this point on, you start breaking over into legal patterns which begin to recognize private ownership of property. And as soon as I can say, this belongs to me and this belongs to the state, now you have two categories you have to worry about: injuries to me and injuries to my state. And the state has some interest to protect, and I have some interests which become legally protectable. And it's out of this kind of root that one begins to develop actions which are civil, private actions for the protection of my body, my health, my house, my family, my cattle, and the state's interests, which are public interests. Another reason for this sort of differentiation is the fact that if we let every person in society be a policeman, what we really develop are a bunch of vendettas, feuds, where families can carry on for generation after generation. We had some experience with this in the early days of the United States down south, where family feuds, the Martins and the McCoys, would develop. And this type of blood vengeance goes on, and it's not good that this should develop. And so there is rather a public vengeance, if you will. If there must be a bloodletting in order to satisfy the animal instinct in people, it's better that it be done by society rather than develop a family fuss, a feud that would perpetuate itself in this way. One sees roots of this back in the Old Testament, which really was a very well developed body of law. But in the concept of an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a life for a life, we are seeing this sort of expression of the public interest in the depreciation or destruction of another human being, not as reimbursement to him, but rather as a society's recognition of its interest in the members of its own group. Well, as the bodies of law developed, there had to be some recognition of different procedures, and this is the place where you can clue in for modern criminal law. Modern criminal law and civil law are very different in their operation. Different primarily in the procedures that are used, in the kind of evidence that's used, and the kind of constitutional requirements that are set up to hedge in the actions. Let me tell you what I mean by this. Let's talk first of all about what we call the procedure or the burden of proof in legal actions. You can think of the beginning of a legal action something the way that you think of football. Somebody's got to kick off. Somebody has to be the offensive side and start the action, has to initiate it. This is, of course, always the plaintiff in civil actions. He's got to come in with enough to get the game going. In a criminal action, it's the state. It's the prosecuting attorney representing the state in its public action. Now, this is a relatively simple concept to pick up, and it's called simply the obligation of initiating the action or going forward with the cause of action. The other one is a little bit more subtle, and it's called the burden of proof. Who has to prove what? And by what margin in order to get a decision? You people, by this time, have become accustomed to hearing me say that all legal questions are questions where there is no final definitive answer, but rather there's a judgment to be made upon the evidence which is produced. Let me show you how that works. In a civil action arising in Massachusetts a century or so ago, a man made a contract by which he said that he would pay 60 cents a gallon for whale oil that was brought in. And if less oil came in this season between these dates than came in last year between the same dates, so that there was a relative scarcity of whale oil, he would pay another 40 cents a gallon, so $1 in all for the whale oil. But if more oil came in, or the same amount of oil came in this year as came in last year, he would pay just the 60 cents and not the 40 cents. The ship, the Lady Grey, she was called, a whaler, came into the harbor the last day. Everybody agreed that the oil would arrive at the time that the anchor went down. And the oil was then there, you see. It had arrived. And the question was, did it arrive within the limited time? Well, everybody agreed that the limit was over at midnight of the last moment of the 12 o'clock hour, just before the 1 o'clock hour, on this day. And so they called the captain of the ship and said, when did you arrive? And he said, well, it was about midnight. And they said, well, when did you drop the hook? And he says, well, it's about midnight. What does your log say? And it says, about midnight. Well, call in the sailor who actually dropped the hook and ask him when he put it down. They called him in and said, when did you put it down? He said, oh, about midnight. Now, this is what the jury's got, and it means in several, a very large quantity of oil, thousands of gallons of oil, it means either 40 cents more or less for the seller of the oil. And what they have to decide is whether or not this ship dropped its anchor before or after midnight. All that they've got are all the people who were there standing around saying, yeah, that's when it was. It was about midnight. And no possible way of splitting it one way or the other. Who is going to win? There is absolutely no factual reason to decide one way or the other. Somebody's got to win. Somebody's got to lose. Now, the decision is going to be made by who has the burden of proof. Upon whose shoulders does the burden rest of making out the case? Well, in a particular instance, it was the plaintiff. He had to show that the ship did arrive. It's on his shoulders to carry the burden. By how much? Anything. If he could have had one guy who could have come in and testified honestly that I was on deck at the time, and I just happened to be winding my watch then, and I heard the splash and saw it was 2 minutes after or 1 minute before. This would have been enough evidence, even a little bit of evidence, because in a civil action, you visualize the scale, and it simply is a preponderance of evidence. You start out with the scale is not evenly balanced, but the plaintiff has the burden of getting in his basic evidence. But this can be tilted, and when the end of the action comes, the guy who's got a simple preponderance of the evidence has carried the burden, and he prevails. It is not this way in a criminal action at all. In a criminal action, the prosecutor must bring in enough evidence so that he has evidence which is beyond any reasonable doubt. The guilt must be shown beyond any reasonable doubt. It's not a matter of a little balance. It's a real tilt to this thing. If the jury, the time that it goes out, can come back and say, well, we sure suspect that this guy is guilty. We sure think he's guilty. Now, the odds are that he is guilty. We're almost totally persuaded that he's guilty, but there is a lingering doubt in our mind. The state has not carried its burden. You must erase the doubt from the jury. It must be evidence which goes to beyond any reasonable doubt, you see, where it's more than reasonably clear that the guilt is there, or else he's not guilty of a crime. A real difference. A real difference in procedure, a real difference in the kind of evidence which will be admitted. And then you have heaped upon this all sorts of constitutional protections. Man has a right to be tried by a jury. Absolute right in the United States to be tried by a jury. He can waive it, but he has an absolute right to be tried by a jury. He has a right to counsel. If he can't afford it himself, the state must cough up the money to compensate counsel to defend this man. That sounds better than it really is, you know. The amount of money which the state pays in this instance is $10 a day, and you don't find many lawyers who really rush for this kind of employment, because that means $10 a day in the courtroom and no compensation at all for the 5 days that you spend getting ready for that day in the courtroom. So you're really working a week for 10 bucks, and it's hard to keep the wife happy on that kind of compensation. But at least the man does not go to trial without counsel. The judge will see to it that some lawyer volunteers. This is why you don't sit in the courtroom waiting to try your case on the day that criminal cases are assigned. Because if you get an indigent there, the judge will lean over and say, Mr. Reiki, you will defend this man. You say, yes, sir. Your Honor, glad to. So you stay home that day. You have a right to counsel, you have a right to jury trial, you have a right to not incriminate yourself by your testimony, you see, you can't be put on the stand. All of these constitutional protections, and there are many more that we won't stop to talk about, are here to load the scale in favor of the defendant against the state. Why? That's the big problem. Why? Well, let's take a case. To try and illustrate the point. It's one that I used last week, and some of you who were here then will forgive me for using it again. Let's assume that a man steals my automobile. I'm a private person. I own an automobile. Somebody steals it from me. I have a civil action to go after the automobile and recover it. This is called an action in replevin, by which I take back the automobile, or I can go after an action in trover, one for money, the value. He took my car, and now, in effect, the law will say that he bought it from me, and if he's got enough money, he'll have to pay me the money for it, damages for having taken my car. I can do this in a civil action. If I, a private person, do this in a civil action, a private action, all I have to do is that he took the car wrongfully by a preponderance of evidence. If the car is nowhere around, if I can't show that the car is still there or something of this sort, all I have to do is show by a simple preponderance that he took the car wrongfully, and I'll get my money back from it. But if the prosecuting attorney wants to come in and fine the man, charge him, say, the same amount of money in a fine, in a criminal action, let's leave imprisonment out of it for a moment, simply a fine, so that out of the guy's pocket is going to come the same number of dollars. The prosecuting attorney has an infinitely heavier burden to carry to succeed in getting a fine imposed than I would have as a private litigant in getting damages. I could win very readily on 2.5 inches worth of evidence, and the prosecuting attorney can't make it unless he's got a full foot of evidence, because he's got to get beyond any reasonable doubt. All I have to do is get a preponderance. The effect on the man is the same. Why the different burdens? I can put the guy on the stand and say to him, did you take my automobile? The prosecuting attorney can't do this if the guy doesn't want to testify. Why the difference in constitutional protections? The difference is the thing that Paul was talking about this morning. It's tough for one person to occupy a double role. Paul got quite enthusiastic at this point. He even managed to beat the sides of the podium a little bit, and that's pretty good for an economist. Maybe this was the preacher coming out in a moment. No man can be a judge in his own case. It's sort of a fundamental principle of law, you see. The state brings an action as prosecutor. The state sits there as the judge. I don't know, it's different men. It's Prosecutor Smith and Judge Brown. But the state is prosecuting and the state is defending. And it's tough for a person to occupy a double role. We ask quite a few people to occupy double roles. Unions do some of this, of course. Mothers do this all the time. You fathers will appreciate this sort of thing. When I come home after a tough day at the office, heavy work, long pencil that day, come home and Jane says, "Today the kids have just been terrible. I haven't had a moment's rest. Things have been upset. Do something, see?" So she is now the prosecuting attorney. And I hear the case, I may even hear the kids having some sense of fairness in this. And after I've heard them, she's carried beyond a reasonable doubt, no question, the offense is there. I get ready to apply the sanction of the criminal law. No TV for a week or whatever it may be. And just about the time that I get ready, she comes out the other side and says, "Well, of course, they didn't sleep well last night. And they have been hard-pressed at school." Here is the prosecutor suddenly whipping out, and she comes out strong for the defense. You see this in juvenile courts all the time. The probation officer, so-called, very frequently occupies this double role. He comes in and tells the judge, "This is the kid that threw the rock through the window." Of course, who wouldn't under these circumstances? And the probation officer is in a tough spot here. No one can operate as efficiently in a dual role with conflicting interests as if you have two people representing the two sides in order to dramatize the positions for the judge. That's why we almost always have separate attorneys for separate interests. In the state of Washington, we have what's known as the community property law, where a husband and wife own things as a community interest, jointly. I once represented the community property interests in an estate. I didn't represent the husband. The husband was represented by an attorney. I did not represent the wife. The wife was represented by an attorney. I represented the marital community. I had the doggondest time trying to talk to my client. But it served its purpose nicely, because here was the husband's distinct interest, there were the wife's distinct interests, and every once in a while I'd get to pop up and say, "Now, Your Honor, on behalf of the marital community." So it dramatizes the interest that's there so that you can keep them identified. Back to the civil action for the car. When the state sits there as the referee and listens to me as the plaintiff in the civil action, and then it listens to the man that I'm suing as the defendant in the civil action, the state is ready for all our polemics, for our arguments, for our contentions, and we can just get as extreme as we like. The state won't be biased. The judge will sit there and listen impartially and sift out truth and falsity. But when the state is the prosecutor, and when it's the state that's been injured, when it's out to avenge its own hurt, then the impartiality of the state is apt to be lost. And the body which is supposed to be the regulator, the governor, the modifier, the pacifier, to serve this function, is apt to become avenging. And a government can be tyrannical very quickly. So when it is the public interest and the public prosecution that's going on, we check and balance all the way through. The jury is there to check the judge. The judge is there to check the jury. Our whole system of government, as well as law, is built on the idea of checks and balances. It is, to me, a very fascinating idea that in theology we assume, and indeed I think profess, that God is able to bind himself. God whose word cannot be broken. God who makes the covenant. And we trust God not to become tyrannical, but to keep his word. The rainbows in the sky yesterday, illustrating this sort of thing. A state cannot be trusted to do this. A state must be checked by the people that it governs. The state must be kept under the dominance of the people. not the people under the dominance of the state, and therefore the whole concept of checks and balances, which makes the procedural and evidentiary differentiations in criminal law compared to civil law, I think, understandable. It's hard enough to know what is civil or criminal law, incidentally. Is a juvenile action where a kid is taken away from home against his will and put into an institution behind bars with guards up on the wall, not being convicted of a crime? Well, no, theoretically he is not. That's a civil action, and he's being protected. The state is helping him work out his problems by putting him into an institution where he can't go away because they've got guards with guns up on the walls. But that's not a criminal action. This is sort of like an elephant giving a mosquito a friendly pat on the back. It's a little bit overwhelming at times, but nonetheless, it is there. Well, now, let's go beyond this for a moment. Suppose that we've gone through these procedural problems and that you now understand the reasons for some of the rather stringent requirements we put upon the state to get a conviction. What are you going to do after you've convicted the person? What is the objective? Is the objective to punish? Is the objective to wreak vengeance? Is the objective to take this person who has committed a wrong and do something about it? Professor Hain has been beating us for the last two Vesper services with the same psalm, and it is interesting. The more you read, the more you read it, the more it looks. A couple passages from it. It says, "Give them according to their deeds and according to the wickedness of their endeavors." In other words, give them what they deserve. That's exactly what the next verse says. "Give them after the work of their hands. Render to them their just desert." And we have this thought, Romans 13, which I am fond of quoting, and I won't read now because of the time. It has this same thought running through it. The state ordained by God or authorized by God, and the officer is the agent of God to enact or carry out God's wrath for misdeeds. Does that really mean that we are to punish? I don't mean rehabilitate now, but I mean punish. Is that the theological idea? Even the Mikado gets into this thing with its lovely song, "Our object all sublime we will achieve in time, to make the punishment fit the crime, the punishment fit the crime." See? For every wrong, there is a punishment that fits. If a man steals $5, he gets 5 days. If he steals $10, he gets 10 days. And the lovely idea of justice, if I steal $5, I get 5 days. If you steal $5, you get 5 days. Everybody gets the same thing. This justice, blind and with the sword up here, and everybody gets their head cut off in the same neat stroke. Now, if you were really thinking about justice now as being equality of punishment for equal offenses, then you'd be happy with this. And I'm suggesting to you this is just as unchristian as it can possibly be. I think this is a distortion of the entire concept here. I think that the purpose here is to protect the state, to rehabilitate the offender. Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. I will repay. I don't think it's our job to wreak vengeance, to harm people because of their misconduct. I think the law was given to us for the purpose, a tool, a means of operating for the salvation in the economic or human life sense of society, so that we can live together with a minimum amount of friction. If there is any validity to this idea, then it would make much more sense not to make the punishment fit the crime, but to make the treatment fit the offender. Not everybody needs the same sort of disciplinary treatment, you know. One child in the family will react quickly to the slightest suggestion of displeasure by the parents. Another child takes a little bit more talking to before you get this same sort of reforming attitude on the part of the child. Same thing is true with offenders. Some types of offenders respond much more favorably and promptly to correction than others do. For this reason, There has been, in recent years, the development of what is called indeterminate sentencing, where the judge simply, first of all, determines that procedurally due process requirements have been met, that the evidence is there, that the proof is there beyond any reasonable doubt of guilt, and then the judge says, you are guilty of a crime, off you go to the Board of Prison Terms and Paroles, and they will work out a program which will have a rehabilitative effect upon you. Whether or not you will be in prison for 1 week or 5 years is determined by the Board of Prison Terms and Paroles. How much do you need? Not all thieves need the same treatment. Not all murderers need the same treatment. Not all check forgers need the same treatment. And certainly, from one class of crime to another, the treatment to be accorded is quite different. The rates of recidivism, that is, the inclination to repeat the offense, much, much higher in certain types of crimes than in others. For example, the forgers of checks have a good record for getting out there and doing it again. This is a way of life with these people. This is their profession. Murderers almost never repeat. That's not a way of life. It's a sudden, impassioned, impulsive act that leads to a murder. It's not something that you plan in advance. You don't print up the checks and practice the signature. You don't pick out your victims 3 months in advance. There are such things as murder incorporated, murder for profit, but this is a rare instance, you know. Basically, this is not a commercial undertaking the way stealing cars or forging checks or something of this sort would be. In our system today, we have some different concepts, and I would like to mention them to you simply so you'll know about them and can think about them. A man is found to have committed a crime. A judge may first of all now say, I'm not even going to enter the sentence. I'm going to suspend sentencing you in order that you won't have a criminal record. A criminal record means something in life. You've got a criminal record, want to get a bond, want to join the armed services, a number of other things that we do in our lifetime. The fact that you have been found guilty of a crime and sentenced someplace is real dynamite. Even the fact that you've been arrested is real dynamite for a good many bonding agencies and other types of organizations. Or a judge may simply suspend the whole operation and say, let's just keep this between us for the time being. I'll just suspend anything further. No black marks on your record, but just between us two, don't you get in trouble. Because if you do, I'm going to pull out the suspenders and bam, it's going to fall down on your head. The suspension of sentence is one thing. Probation is another thing which is frequently used. I am going to find you guilty of this crime. I now find you guilty of this. And I'm going to sentence you to 5 years at hard labor or less, depending on what the Board of Prison Terms thinks about it. But right now, rather than sending you to the prison, I'm going to put you on probation. On condition. Don't get out of line. If you do, well, you have to go down and serve your sentence. Now, the probation is used before the guy ever goes to jail. If he goes to jail and gets down there and is pretty cooperative, the Board of Prison Terms and Parole may say to him, we're going to put you on parole. You've been here, we've watched you, and now we'll put you out on parole. It's like probation or suspension, only it comes after the original commitment. And this, again, is on condition of good behavior on the outside. Well, suspension, indeterminate sentence, probation, parole, making the rehabilitative efforts fit the needs of the offender rather than simply being regulated by the act that he's done makes a lot of sense sociologically. Whether or not there's a theological problem there that you've got to wrestle with is one that I think you ought to wrestle with a little bit and try and meet that in your own mind. Now let's take the last step here in the few minutes that we have remaining and talk about the rather dramatic illustration that our society produces, and that is capital punishment. I want to do two things with this. One is to get set up for tomorrow morning when we talk about war. Can you really kill people? Can a Christian ever kill anybody deliberately under any circumstances? Peacefully, as a result of a crime, capital punishment, or in war? And how do we shape up our thinking? That's preparation for tomorrow. For today, what is the utility, if any, of capital punishment? Well, first of all, you could say it's what God wants us to do. God wants us to punish these people. You can argue that way if you like. I personally am going to be on the opposite side of that fence. I think God does not tell us that it is our Christian duty to kill people. It seems to me that that's not the way the book reads. You can say, well, it is a very effective type of protection for society. A man who has committed a crime, which is a capital crime, and who is executed will never commit that crime again. And I must agree with you, that's true. It is an effective form of protection against that individual. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's an effective type of protection against other individuals. Indeed, there is some indication that the very fact of an execution is in itself inciting to other crimes of exactly the same nature. It is not simply coincidental that when a man commits a murder of a certain kind, by certain means, blowing up an airplane, and when this guy gets the notoriety that he gets in a capital offense case, that almost inevitably you will find another little outbreak of the same kinds of crimes, almost to exact detail, by other people who have watched and now who imitate out of a sort of demonic desire to be punished. It is true, demonstrated nicely by studies, that there is an urge to be punished in a good many people, and an urge to confess. This is why every murder, almost every murder that ever occurs, well, the next thing the police know, they've got people walking in the front door and saying, arrest me, I did it. And the police have become quite artful in screening these people out, and they say, what kind of a knife did you use? And he says, one about that long, and the police says, okay, out, this guy was shot. This happens all the time, you see, people confess, confess, confess to crimes that they did not commit at all. You've got that to worry about. But I would grant you that at least for the one guy who's executed, that you're protected against him. No more protection, however, than you'd get if you incarcerated him and kept him there, and hopefully he could be rehabilitated. Obviously, capital punishment is punitive in the extreme sense. It certainly alienates this guy from any hope of rehabilitation, perfectly obvious. It would be interesting, I think, to notice what is going on in the United States with reference to capital punishment, because if you happen to be a justice-oriented person, and I must confess that Paul is right, I am not very much impressed by justice in the way that most people think about it, but if you happen to like justice, we aren't getting it in capital punishment. Many more non-white Protestant Caucasians are convicted of capital offenses today, and the minority groups are convicted of capital offenses. The Negro, the Mexican, the Oriental, these people furnish most of the convictions. Now, it is true that some of the minority races commit more crimes per 100 persons than do white Protestants, or white Catholics for that matter, per 100. And there are probably good reasons for this too. The point is, though, that if you take 100 murders committed by white persons and 100 murders committed by Negro persons, you will have more convictions in the 100 cases by Negroes than you will in the whites. That's bad enough by itself, but it gets worse rapidly from that point on. If you take 10 persons who are sentenced to death by courts for murder, 10 white and 10 black, for example, and start looking at the number of instances in which a governor exercises his powers to pardon, governors never pardon Negro persons. Maybe my statement is too broad. Almost never pardon Negro persons. The people who get clemency from the governor are the white persons, not the minority races. And if you go one step further and ask who actually dies in the United States, here you get your most gross distortion of all. We hang very few white persons, or we execute very few white persons. Of the 10 that are convicted, some are pardoned, the others simply wait. A few will ultimately write 5 or 6 books and then finally be executed someplace down the line, white ones. The Negroes never get this chance. The Indians never get this chance. The Mexicans never get this chance. They simply are convicted, they don't get pardoned, and they die. And in terms of equal treatment, it simply is not there. We don't have such a great volume of capital cases anymore, and I think this is a very good thing, personally. But let's talk about the merits of it for a moment. What is its utility in our society? Capital offense, capital punishment I'm talking about. Does it really deter? There is no evidence that is worthwhile that capital punishment deters anybody. There is no evidence that's worthwhile that it doesn't deter anybody. This is simply not something that you can demonstrate one way or the other. We have states in the United States where 2 adjoining sovereign states, one has had capital punishment since it was organized and the other one has not. The same population, essentially. I mean, the same number percentage-wise of Norwegians, Swedes, Germans, so forth. One state happily goes along with this many murders per year. The other one goes along with that many murders per year. There just isn't any difference. There is one case that I know of in which a murderer took his intended victim out of a non-capital punishment state to a capital punishment state. I'm sorry, the other way around. In the state where he first grabbed his intended victim, capital punishment. One case that I know of where this guy takes him to the other state and kills him where there is no capital punishment for this crime. Only one, this is my point. I can give you hundreds of cases in which other kinds of business crimes are carefully committed in states where the punishment is minimal. There is this deliberate sort of a planning effect. There simply is no good evidence that capital punishment deters. Why? Well, because murders aren't planned. They're impulsive, off-the-cuff sorts of things. You get mad, you get angry at somebody, and in the heat of your anger, without reflection, really, you commit the murder. But let's skip that point. I grant you right now, just for purposes of argument, I'll simply concede that capital punishment does have some deterrent effect. Just for purposes of argument, mind you. That's all, because I don't believe it. But let's assume that it does have some value. What's the price you pay for it? I think that anyone who has practiced law would tell you that the mere fact that capital punishment exists is a serious distortion of the entire criminal law process. Let me give real fast 2 illustrations of what I'm talking about here, simple ones, and there are a lot more like this. Take, first of all, the selection of a jury. By statute, in almost every state, a juror who does not believe in capital punishment is not eligible to sit on a jury panel where capital punishment is a possible consequence. Well, that makes a certain amount of sense, doesn't it? If this is the penalty that's to be inflicted and you ask the prospective juror, could you, under any circumstances of guilt, recommend death penalty? And the juror says, no, I could not. My conscience would never permit me to do that. Well, obviously, there's not going to be a fair trial. And so you throw him out. You can't accept this guy for the jury. Who does that leave? That leaves the guy who says, yeah, I think capital punishment is a good idea. Now, what kind of a jury do you get? A random, impartial, unbiased body that's going to exercise free, unprejudiced judgment? Well, obviously not. You have immediately slanted your whole jury toward one which is inclined to be a hanging jury by its very composition. Illustration number 1. Illustration number 2 is a much more serious one. That one I think is bad enough, but this one is much worse. It's a little more technical. You all know that prosecuting attorneys bargain with persons accused. They say, we think that we can get you on grand larceny for stealing this thing. We think we've got enough evidence so that we can convict you of grand larceny. And the defendant and his counsel says, you haven't. You can't bring it off. You need a full foot of evidence, and all you've got is 10 inches. Well, we're going to make a real whirl at it, says the prosecuting attorney, and we think we can do it. Well, I'll tell you what we'll do. If you will plead guilty to petty larceny, you'll cop a plea, as the expression goes. If you will plead guilty and save us the burden of proving this to a lesser offense, we'll let you plead guilty to that lesser offense, although we think we could get you for the bigger one. Well, if the defense counsel is in a position where he is going like this about whether or not they could really get his client on the grand larceny thing, he's apt to buy that and cop the plea, plead guilty to the lesser offense, simply to avoid the possibility of the big one. Now, there is a certain amount of tolerable leverage that goes into this sort of thing, and pleas are copped with more or less frequency right along the line. There's nothing wrong with this. This is part of the bargaining context of life. And one day, the prosecuting attorney comes to you, and he says, I think I've got a case against your client for manslaughter. He could get 20 years in prison for this maximum in this hypothetical state. And you say, you haven't got a fighting chance of proving manslaughter. Not a fighting chance. And you're serious about it. And that's just about the way it stands. And he says to it, no, I don't suppose I could prove it, but you're going to plead guilty. And you say, you're nuts, man. My client will never plead guilty to a charge of manslaughter. And he says, how would you like to see him hang? Because we're going in and say he's guilty of first degree. You want to lose that one? And stand there and watch your client dance on the end of a rope? And you say, prosecutor, you don't have the evidence for any conviction at all. And he says, my evidence for first degree murder is just as good as my evidence for manslaughter. And if I'm going to try one, I'm going to go all the way. I'm going to shoot for the death penalty. Now, your odds of winning are 6-4, defense counsel. That's right. They're 6-4. You've got 6 chances out of 10 that the prosecutor can't make his case. But if you lose, he dies. If this were the difference between 5 years and 10 and you had a 6-4 odds, you'd go ahead and defend the man. You should go to your client and say, look, I think I can win this case. 6 times out of 10, I'll win this one for you. And he says, what happens if you lose, counselor? Well, you're kind of rough. He says, what's our alternative? You can plead guilty to manslaughter. And he says, I'll take it. And you say, but you didn't do it. And he says, look, you're asking me to bet on this kind of a margin with my life, counselor. This is not an academic question with me. As a result, there is a real tendency in the United States today to use that death penalty for purposes of, I now use the word, coercion rather than bargaining. When bargaining stops being bargaining and gets to be coercion, I don't know. Prosecuting attorneys run for public office. One of the things that people like to see is convictions of people who have committed heinous acts in society. They like to get convictions. So they come around and they say to you, you're going to plead guilty to manslaughter. That's what we think your man did. And you're going to plead guilty to that manslaughter because if you don't, we're going to try him for murder. Go home and tell your boy that. As a result, you get this tremendous distortion of the criminal law process itself. Now, it's bad enough in the larceny case, but I say this is tolerable. I can live with this in a imprisonment or a fine situation. But the odds are too heavily weighted for the system to bear it when you get into the possibility that a man loses his life. These two illustrations, the effect of the very existence of the capital punishment thing on the selection of a jury, the distorting effect upon the pleading guilty process, can be duplicated in perhaps 6, 7, 8 other instances where the existence of death penalty, has a very distorting effect upon the rather delicate machinery of the criminal law process. And if we had more time, we could talk about some more. I think the two examples are good enough for the purpose. Finally, suppose that I grant it has a deterrent effect suppose that it doesn't upset the machinery so badly that it causes more damage than it does good. Give you both of those things just for purposes of argument. Concede for a moment that there is some value in it. We're doing it for the wrong offenses. If you really want to try and deter somebody, don't try and deter the murderer, the guy who kills in rage. He is the man who is most likely to be rehabilitated. It is common knowledge among screws, it's the name of the guards and the people who work in the penal institutions, that if you want a babysitter to take care of your kids when you're going downtown for a movie, the person that is most likely to be trusted in the entire penitentiary is a man who's committed a murder. He is the most trustworthy guy in the pen. And if you don't want your kids hurt, get somebody who has just rubbed out his wife and kids. And in a moment of anger, he is the most likely person for rehabilitation. He is the least likely person to be deterred by the presence of a death penalty. If you want to deter somebody, try capital punishment for forgers of checks, because these are the guys who play odds. Now, they're the guys who figure out, I think I can make this money by writing the checks, and the penalty is rather light anyway. They are thinkers, you see, they're businessmen crooks. They are the ones who can be deterred. This is not true of those offenses where we use capital punishment today. These are the non-thinking crooks that we kill over here. Now, a break so we can have coffee, but will you please now let this discussion slide right on over to war and peace. Is the same sort of thinking applied, the same sort of forces applicable, same machinery operate when we start talking about international problems, international conflicts, and international crimes?